We're proud to announce that the new 1001 Stories Network app is now available at the Apple App Store. This app is free and combines all our 1001 shows. Plus, it offers all kinds of conveniences, like car mode and playlists. To gain access to all our archives and get special new bonus episodes, we suggest you become a premium member at the link shown here in our show notes or at 1001storiespodcast.com. The name of that app, again, is 1001 Stories Network. Today, we're very proud to have Air Force Chief of Staff and four-star general, Tony McPeak, with us to take us from the war in Vietnam to the current threats in Korea and elsewhere. Are we ready? And what have we learned? Tony flew 269 air combat missions and 98 MISTI missions over Vietnam, was involved in planning the Gulf War, and has been a major force for the U.S. in strategy and combat readiness. He speaks what's on his mind and doesn't pull any punches, as you'll find out when you read his new book, Roles and Missions, which is the third in a trilogy of books which include Below the Zone and Hangar Flying. And that's a great place to start as we go back to the 60s to look at where our Air Force was at that time, what we had in the air, why we're in Vietnam, and what we learned. For our younger listeners, I'm hoping you can set the stage for the Vietnam War, explain why we were there, was it a just cause, and what prevented us from winning it. What did we learn from it?
John, I just spent 5 years working with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War documentary. That's 10 episodes, 18 hours of film, and I'm in 4 of the episodes. I was interviewed for it, and I'm in 4 of the episodes, and I'm credited as a technical advisor on every episode. So I worked with him for a long time. I think that documentary is very good at explaining, the fundamental questions of why were we there and what happened to us. The short answer to that is we sort of fumbled our way in. First of all, we tried to help the French win, and when they got defeated, we sort of filled what we thought was a vacuum. And there was this ill-conceived notion that if Vietnam fell to the communists, it was just the first domino and the others in Southeast Asia would fall, which turned out not to be true because we lost Vietnam. The South was incorporated into the North. And, within another decade or so, the Berlin Wall fell over. The Soviet Union disappeared from history. The Warsaw Pact evaporated. So if anything, that first domino, you'd have to say led to the exact opposite of what the domino theory predicted, that we would lose worldwide in the struggle against communists. So we went in, I think, under false reasoning, bad rationale. We lost, and the consequences were anything but those predicted. We're closer today to Vietnam than we have been in a long time. I mean, they're very friendly to us. It's a vigorous, growing economy, and I don't favor the administration there. I mean, it's a dictatorship still, and I don't like that. But the Saigon regime was also a dictatorship and a corrupt one at that from top to bottom, and so, there are worse things that can happen to us than to lose that one.
You flew 269 air combat missions and 98 MISTI missions. Can you explain the difference between the two and what those missions accomplished?
Well, most of my missions were ordinary fighter pilot attack missions. You go out and attack some target. We had those were flown in country by and large. So although I did fly quite a few out of country sorties in support of operations in Laos. The MISTI sorties were forward air controller sorties. We went over there and tried to find the targets for attack, and so we didn't carry munitions ourselves aside from 20 millimeter, which we could and did use for strafing on Laos, but we had marking rockets, 2.75 folding fin, white phosphorus, Willy Pete, we called it, marking rockets. So if we found a target, we would call the fighters in loaded with high explosives, and we'd mark it for them with white phosphorus and control that attack. So to find targets, you had to get down in Laos and look under trees, and of course that meant a lot more vulnerability. Only time I was ever hit by ground fire in Southeast Asia, I was hit by a 9 millimeter, somebody with a handgun.
Yep.
I mean, pistols were. That was a little more dangerous, and we limited those missions over there to 100 sorties. I never did get 100. I got to 98 because I was actually relieved as I was a commander of that squadron, and we moved from Phuket down to Tuiwa, and the new guy wanted his own guy in charge of that squadron, so he relieved me, two sorties early, which I'm still irritated about, and kicked me upstairs and put him to work directly for him. I became the chief of his stand eval, what we call standardization evaluation group, reporting directly to the guy who'd fired me, and in charge of giving all the rest of the air crews their annual, check rides and certifying that they were, full up rounds. So he didn't really fire me. He sort of hired me to come up and be in charge of, the wing, the whole wing. But I always considered a firing, and I wanted to fly those last two missions, but I never got to do it.
Now those misty missions were daylight missions, right?
Yeah. We had no capability to get down on a trail at night and look back in the trees and try to find truck parks and, warehouses and storage areas and so forth, which is what we were looking for.
And that was the Ho Chi Minh?
Now we do.
That was the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
That was the Ho Chi Minh. That's correct. That was a trail. And of course, it was manned by and large by North Vietnam regular troops rather than, Pathet Lao or in-country. So often you went against kind of VC defenses or Viet Cong defenses. But these guys were North Vietnamese regular troops and better equipped, better trained, tougher guys, in general.
In the first book you wrote of what is called, what some people call the trilogy, the book called Hangar Flying, what were the toughest sections of that book for you to write, or maybe the toughest memories that you had?
Well, it was clear to me from kind of the moment I landed in Vietnam that we were in a losing fight. The Saigon government was a Catholic regime in a largely Buddhist country, a regime of outsiders, and most of the guys were North Vietnamese, from Hanoi, that were displaced south when Ho Chi Minh came to power in the north, and really, really corrupt. It was sort of a family operation, but it extended down into their armed forces so that all the top-tier generals were on the take. The year I was there, the official desertion rate from South Vietnamese forces was almost 400 people a month. A battalion a month they were losing to just desertion. And, of course, none of those names ever came off the payroll because the division commander and the corps commanders and so forth kept paying these people who were gone, and that money went right in their pockets. So, in addition, of course, the North had a lot going for it. They were purely nationalist people. They weren't fighting with the outside help of, us or any what might be regarded as imperial power. So here's Vietnam that had fought against the Chinese, they'd fought against the French, they'd fought against the Japanese in World War II, they fought against the French when they came back. Now they're fighting against us. So their line was, you know, we're fighting to get rid of these foreign powers, take control of our own country. That's a pretty good argument. I mean, we did that in the revolution. And then they said they were fighting to reunify their own country. And, of course, we could understand that, too. We did that in the Civil War. So the South, it seemed to me, had very poor rationale for us to support them, and the North had pretty good rationale. So, you know, I thought we were on backing a losing cause from the beginning, but I was a professional. I mean, I wasn't a draftee, you know, some 18-year-old kid. I was a major in my early 30s, a unit commander eventually when I got command of the Misties. And I wasn't there because I was angry with anybody. I was there because the president said, go fight these guys. And, you know, I'm a hired gun, in a sense, a lifer, signed up professional military guy. So I went, did the best I could. But it was obvious to me that in the long run, we could only prop up the Saigon regime for so long. And eventually, you know, their own sins would come to roost. And that's exactly what happened by the early 70s. It was just a calamity. We eventually did withdraw under terms that sealed Saigon's fate. You know, I mean, under the terms of withdrawal, we left behind a couple hundred thousand NVA troops in South Vietnam. We had always wanted to negotiate to get them out, and the Saigon government, you know, that was a make-or-break thing for them, the removal of these foreign troops. But at the end of the day, we wanted our POWs back, and we knew we were, giving up Saigon, but that's what we negotiated. That's what Kissinger eventually signed up to. And so at that point, from then on till 1975, it was just a matter of time.
What countries were involved in creating unrest in the U.S.? Back then, social media was nowhere near what it is today. In fact, it was non-existent. We didn't have internet back in those days. Who was right. working against us, and how much did the turmoil that was created in Washington and on college campuses affect the outcome of the war?
Well, I think it affected it a lot, but I don't believe it was a foreign effort. I mean, the opposition to the war was domestic. You know,
okay.
I mean, I know some of these guys that threw their medals over the fence. You know, John Kerry led the opposition. He wasn't speaking on behalf of anybody except himself. So good, patriotic Americans just thought we were doing the wrong thing. And they led the opposition, and that opposition was on college campuses and everywhere in this country. And eventually, I think it was crucial. I mean, when Walter Cronkite came back from a visit to Vietnam and announced on CBS Evening News that we were backing a losing cause, we were in a quagmire, I think was his direct words, Americans trusted Walter Cronkite more than they did Richard Nixon. And so Cronkite wasn't speaking on behalf of Red China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a good guy. And so he finally came to a reluctant conclusion that this was nonsense, and that the best course of action was us to just finish up and leave. But no doubt that public opposition was a center of gravity. I mean, we could only operate for any democracy can only operate so long in a combat, overseas combat, without the support of its own people. And gradually, it was clear that the people didn't support us. I mean, Lyndon Johnson would certainly have loved to run for another term, but he sensed, and rightly so, that there was too much opposition to the Vietnam War and his role in it. And so he didn't seek renomination. At the end of the day, that public opposition in our country, which was right, I think. I mean, they assessed the situation correctly, and no doubt it was responsible for our withdrawal. Now, so in a sense, you know, we never lost a military battle in Vietnam, but we lost the war because we got in a position where we couldn't get widespread public support for what we were doing there.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're approaching the anniversary of the Tet Offensive. What was the Tet Offensive?
Well, Tet was an all-out full-court press by the North and by the Viet Cong guerrillas in the South to topple the Saigon government. And, by the way, to give us a bloody nose in the process. First of all, it's interesting to note, and Ken Burns and Lynn Novick make this point in their documentary, that Ho Chi Minh was surprised by the Tet Offensive. By the time, early 1968, he had been essentially elbowed aside by others in the Politburo in Hanoi. And so when they woke him up and said, hey, we've launched attack all across South Vietnam on every major city, including Saigon, he was very surprised. And, of course, Marshal Giap, their senior military guy, was also surprised. He was in Eastern Europe in a hospital getting medical treatment. So that's one interesting aspect of this, that this offensive was launched without the approval or even the knowledge of the senior guy, the guy we thought was in charge, Ho Chi Minh. Now, the result was a calamity for the Viet Cong. They never recovered from it. I mean, they were killed in very large numbers. They came out in the open to fight for the first time in Vietnam and essentially opened themselves up to air attack. And they were just decimated. I mean, like I say, the VC was never again the force that they were before Tet. And by the way, when Saigon fell in 75, it wasn't to a bunch of pajama-clad, guerrillas. It was to main force NVA units who rolled into Saigon with tanks and surfaced there in SAM missiles and so forth. It was the VC itself was never a major military factor after the Tet Offensive. From then on, the fighting that was done that amounted to anything was done by main force, mainline North Vietnamese army units. So it was a military catastrophe for the Viet Cong, but it was a strategic victory for the North, because up until January of 68, Westmoreland and the president and everybody was saying, well, we can see, the beginning of the end here. We're winning. The body counts are going up. Blah, blah, blah. And then Tet exploded in front of everybody. And the American people saw, well, if this is what winning looks like, let's not hang around here and wait till we lose. So I think that it was a key to undermining U.S. public support for what was going on over there. Even a military disaster as it was a strategic victory and a turning point in the war.
What were you flying in Vietnam, and how have our capabilities changed over the years?
Well, I was flying F-100s, which was not the leading kind of fighter, because by then we already knew the F-100 needed to be replaced, and we eventually did replace it with an Air Force version of the Phantom, the F-4. But it was still, you know, a supersonic jet aircraft, so it was not an old, you know, prop-driven World War II kind of airplane. What we learned in Vietnam applied to the F-4 and the F-105 and the F-100, the main fighters, frontline fighters we used there. Well, I would say we learned three main lessons there. They're all technical. One is we have to hit what we're aiming at. You know, our average miss distance for all bombs dropped in Vietnam was on the order of 100 meters, so 300 feet. Now, that's not bad, because if you drop a 2,000-pound bomb 300 feet from somebody, their eardrums are going to ache for a while. But if the target is a bridge, you can't stand a 100-foot miss, 300-foot miss, 100-meter miss. Or if it's a tank or a truck, you know, these vehicles are made for heavy-duty use, so they're not going to be knocked out by a 100-meter miss. So what we learned, our first lesson was we have to hit what we're aiming at, and that meant we had to go put a full-court press on precision-guided munitions, which we did. And by the time of Desert Storm, you saw, we were using munitions that didn't just hit the truck, they hit the hood ornament, okay? So that's what we need to do. Two, we needed to have an capability to operate at night. We had essentially no capability at night, so the other side owned the night, and they drove down the Ho Chi Minh Trail at night, and they operated at night whenever they could. After the war, after Vietnam, we generated a full-up capability to operate at night. And now Desert Storm kicked off at like 2:30 in the morning, their time, Baghdad time. We prefer to fight at night. Actually, anybody who fights us in the daytime is going to get killed also, but at night, our advantage over everybody is quite wide. So that was, again, something we learned in Vietnam and we fixed. And the third thing we learned is we don't like to go, we bloomed very big on enemy radar. So whenever we went into the north, it was no surprise to anybody. I mean, and they were able to be quite effective with their ground-based defenses, both AAA and surface-to-air missiles, because we just looked very big in both their acquisition radars and in their fire control radars. So we invented stealth. We now have the capability to defeat enemy radars. And so those three things, precision, a stealth, and a night capability, were technical lessons that we learned from Vietnam. And Vietnam lasted long enough that we all learned these lessons. When we came back, we fixed them. Now, there were other lessons learned, but not so much by the Air Force. They were kind of cultural lessons. You know, we can't have NCOs killing their officers or soldiers killing NCOs. We can't have dope, you know, smoking in the front lines and so forth. We needed to correct the, culture in some ways, and I think the Army came back and went to work on that. I mean, guys like Colin Powell and Norm Schwarzkopf reinvented the Army, and the Army is much better today culturally than it was kind of conscription-based, draft-based force that we fought Vietnam with. And there were some technical lessons that I think the Army also learned, but by and large, culturally, the Air Force was in pretty good shape. We needed to pay attention to technical shortcomings, and I can go into why they existed. I mean, basically, the Air Force was a strategic air command, massive retaliation force, and it was built on bombers and nuclear weapons. And we neglected, in the years after Korea, we neglected the kind of changes that we needed to make technically, because the money went to, to retaliatory forces. And mm-hmm. I can't argue that that was a bad thing. We eventually won the Cold War, which was really very important, and I think the strategic forces played a lead role there. But the tactical force was starved and didn't make the investments they needed in technology to ready us for conventional warfare as we then ran into in Vietnam.
You contributed to the Ken Burns Vietnam War documentary. What did you take home from that? How do you recommend it?
Well, I think it's a wonderful piece of work. And I think that because, you know, especially with the younger generation that doesn't read as much printed page as much and relies on video, I think that 18 hours documentary will become sort of the accepted version of what happened to us in Vietnam. And so I'm very glad to have been a part of it. He interviewed a couple hundred people. 88 of them are in the documentary. I feel lucky that I was one of them. So our stories will come through as part of explaining, you know, what happened to us there and so forth. I spent 5 years working on it because I only was interviewed one time for a couple of hours, but then they kind of brought me into the family that produced that film, and so I worked for them worked with them for a long time, got to know them. I think they're very bright people. Ken, of course, and Lynn Novick is co-director, and I'm proud of the part I played there. I think that people who invest 18 hours in that documentary will their time repaid over and over again with an understanding of what really happened then.
There's been a lot of movies made about Vietnam by people with different viewpoints to the younger generations. If they were going to watch two movies that covered the Vietnam War, which ones would you recommend?
Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now. But they're not the only ones. I thought Full Metal Jacket is great. Platoon is great. And, by the way, watch Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's documentary about the Vietnam War. So I frankly would put it at the top of the list. But the popular movies I love most are Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now. And neither one of them is accurate, you know? Mm-hmm. They're full of artistic license. But like a novel, they can capture the sense of what went on then, even though they're not true histories. So, yeah, take a look.
In your second book of the trilogy, called Below the Zone, what do you cover in that story, and what will the reader take home from that?
Well, it's about peacetime. You know, from the end of Vietnam until I became chief of staff 4 months before Desert Storm, it was a long period of peace. And in that period, we won the Cold War. I mean, it's sort of my take on what being a military professional was like in the years between 1970 and 1990, a 20-year period, which included the fall, finally, of the Berlin Wall, the destruction, of, if you could call it that, of the Warsaw Pact, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, and the disappearance of the Soviet Union. So these are earth-shaking events. I was involved in them like every other military professional during that 20-year period. We can claim that we defeated the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies. And that's as important a military victory as this country's ever had. And we did it without firing a shot, in many ways, you could say. Because the system we put in place to meet their system beat their system, and so we saw what Fukuyama called the end of history. You know, the triumph of democracy, of liberal democracy, the triumph of market-based economics, it turns out it wasn't the end of history because of what happened afterwards, and some of that being mistakes that we made following our victory in the Cold War. But that's what Volume 2 is about, is what it was like to be a military man moving up through the ranks in those peacetime years where I was involved in leadership and administration of small, medium-sized, and large units, but before I became Chief of Staff.
For somebody moving up through the ranks, as you describe your leadership role and the challenges that you had, and I know it's tough to encapsulize an entire novel, and you have a lot to offer. But just short advice, if you can shorten it, what short advice would you give to someone that's moving up through the ranks as he starts to accept new responsibilities and roles?
Well, I think two things are required at small unit level. I mean, up to about, say, squadron size or a company size. The first one is you have to know your business, top to bottom. And the second one is people have to trust you. People around you are close enough to you in a small unit, they can make an assessment whether you're trustworthy or not. So if you can do these two things, if you really know your business, you know, top to bottom, and if people trust you, you'll be a successful leader at small unit level. As you get more and more senior, you get involved in large, medium size and large units, and that's not enough at that point. And I don't want to go into all that's required. I think you still need to know what you're doing. You'll need to be trustworthy. But the point is the units you're in charge of are big enough now. Nobody can see, people don't see a close-up every day, and therefore they can't judge whether you know what you're doing or whether you're trustworthy or not on a day-to-day basis like they can in a small unit. So what's necessary then is something more, and as I say, I don't want to go into great detail, but I'm more and more impressed by the fact that people have to take responsibility for what happens in their organization, even if it's not their direct responsibility. And so, you know, somebody screws up, and it happens all the time in your unit. You don't come out and say, Corporal Jones really blew it. Mm-hmm. You came out and say, I blew it. And then you fix it, you know, behind the scenes. But it's your fault. Whatever happens in your unit, good or bad, and you have to accept that. And it's especially important that you admit it if a mistake was made by you or somebody else. You know, taking responsibility for mistakes. Now take a look at what happens in Washington today and try to find me somebody who's taken responsibility for mistakes that are being made. And we can see them right in front of our eyes. But who's responsible? That's pretty hard to find. Certainly, you know, everybody's willing to step forward if the stock market goes up. So I think, A, you have to take responsibility, especially when you make mistakes. Now, I made a lot of mistakes when I was wearing a uniform, and I wasn't proud of them, but I sure as hell took credit for them, including, by the way, at a time when I was Chief of Staff. Read Volume 3. You will see. You know, I'm quite open about it. You cannot make the number of decisions about changes, and I changed the Air Force as much as anybody, I think.
You changed the uniform at the code at one time, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And you're still trying to survive that one.
I'm still catching hell about that. So, but I admitted it when I made mistakes, and I took responsibility for it. And I'm very proud of the way the Air Force performed under my leadership, and since, by the way, we've been in more or less continuous combat since Desert Storm, 25 years or something like that. I mean, immediately after Desert Storm, we put in no-fly zones in the north and in the south of that country. The combat has continued in both Afghanistan and Iraq. We had Somalia, you know, Mogadishu with Black Hawks down there. We had combat Balkans. Somebody's been shooting at the Air Force more or less continuously for the last 25 years. We haven't really had much time off. And you probably know this, John, but we have lost a total of 6 aircraft in combat during that period, about an aircraft every 4 years. That's amazing. And by the way, one of them shot down was piloted by our present chief of staff, Dave Goldfein. He was shot down in, I think, 1999 in Bosnia in an F-16. We got him back. We have gotten back every single aircrew in those 6 aircraft that were shot down. You haven't seen any of our POWs, you know, on television or anybody walking around with their hands up, raised in the air. We got back every single guy. So it's amazing to me that this isn't front page news in every newspaper in the United States, that in continuous combat, we've lost an airplane every 4 years, and we got everybody back.
That's a fantastic record.
It is, and I am not responsible for it, but the Air Force I left when I left office is the Air Force that did that. I made a lot of mistakes, and I took credit for them, and I did some things that I think produced the Air Force that has this record of accomplishment that, as I say, is absolutely astonishing, eye-opening.
Agreed. Who are our biggest competitors in the air today? Who do we have to look out for?
Well, most of the air forces that we have to look out for are on our side. Mm-hmm. Israel is a very good, small air force. The RAF's vanishing in front of our very eyes. It's a major, major tragedy. But whatever's left of it is pretty good. And so it's true of the French, true of the Luftwaffe, and so forth.
What's causing the RAF? What's putting them on a downhill slide?
The budget. They are a shadow of their former self because they've just been whacked down by budget pressure in the UK. It's true also of some of our other NATO allies, but especially I regret the fact that the RAF is now down to so few combat squadrons. So the air forces we have to worry about are Russia and China. The Japanese Air Force is pretty good. South Korean Air Force is pretty good. North Korea doesn't have an Air Force worth talking about, but they've got, they are a huge threat to American cities, either right now or will be in very short time. I'm worried about that. I think it's the biggest national security problem that faces us right now. But it's not their Air Force. It's it's the rocket force that's the danger here.
Mm-hmm.
So among air forces, it's Russia and China. Russia is very bothersome because they're operating in airspace in which we're operating right now in Syria and Iraq to some extent. But they're being coordinated. I mean, the two air forces are cooperating there, and so far there hasn't been any mischief, although just recently we apparently have attacked ground units that had Russian advisors attached, and so that's, a terribly dangerous situation there. We better be very careful. And in fact, they better be very careful. I mean, the Russian Air Force has done some irresponsible things there, and they face or could face dramatic consequences. Already, they've had one of their aircraft shot down by the Turks. So I think they better be very careful. But by and large, there's an effort underway to coordinate with them and keep the combat forces from confrontation there. what our policy line is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different. And, you know, it's a very dangerous situation. Others ought to be able to read our intentions very clearly and understand exactly what it is that we're up to. And when they don't, that creates uncertainty. And I think that's a very dangerous position to be in. So there's no shortage of communication, but it should be a uniform message from the top to bottom, that, and it isn't right now. So the problem is not that we don't know how to communicate. The problem is we don't have a unified, sensible, thought through, coordinated policy line to peddle at every level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now let's take the present problem in Korea. I mean, we've got a crazy man in North Korea who says he's got a red button on his desk that can threaten destruction of American cities. That's bad enough. But now we got a president who goes back and says, well, my button's bigger than yours, you know, and calls him Rocket Man.
Mm-hmm.
This is not calculated to improve the security and safety of America, mm-hmm. in my judgment. I am signed up to it. You know, I believe in defending the people and the institutions and the property of American citizens. So for me, this is not a trivial issue.
Right.
So I regard the development of a capability in the North, North Korea, to destroy Chicago, or even perhaps Washington or New York City, certainly Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco. I regard this as a ominous development
mm-hmm.
that has to be changed. I mean, this country possesses armed forces for the purpose of eliminating threats like this.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular threat is the best case I've ever seen in favor of preemptive attack.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot allow this crazy person in Pyongyang to be able to evaporate Chicago or Denver whenever he decides he wants to.
Do you think he has that capability right now, or do you think he's just saying he has it?
I'm not sure. We know he has nuclear weapons because he's exploded them.
Right.
Right? He's tested them.
Mm-hmm.
We know he has rockets that go some distance, and that distance appears to perhaps extend to Chicago. And if he can't get to New York City and Washington just yet, it appears that it's only a question of time. What we don't know is whether he can package the munitions and put them on rockets with this kind of range.
Mm-hmm.
But I take at face value the fact that he either has that now or he will have it soon. I think there's a fuse burning on this problem. Mm-hmm. We have a limited time to take these capabilities away from him. And so I would set a date certain. Now, by the way, I don't want to use nuclear weapons against North Vietnam, but I don't think we have to. I think we can solve this problem with conventional munitions. And I don't want to get involved with a war of any kind, conventional or nuclear, before we exhaust every other capability. You know, if we can negotiate with the guy, great. And there are things that he wants. He wants diplomatic recognition. He wants to end the Korean War. We never have. We're still under an armistice there.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to reduce, or eliminate the economic sanctions we've put on him. So there's lots of those things and other things that we could put on the table here.
And yet he's still taking hostages.
Well, I'm not saying the guy's sane. I'm saying, if we can negotiate with him, we have some carrots that we could put on the table here. It's not all stick. If the Chinese can help us, mm-hmm. by all means, let's get them involved. I mean, Beijing is threatened more than Washington. Mm-hmm. I can't understand why the Chinese would ever want North Korea to have nuclear munitions and the ability to deliver them at ranges certainly including Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians, you know, Vladivostok is a very large Russian city, you know, not very far from North Korea. So let's get them involved. So I would favor using every other tool in our toolbox before we engage in a conventional attack. But I think we have used most of these tools, and I'm not optimistic that any of them will work. And so my own private conviction is we have to intervene. I would want to do it with conventional munitions, and that will be a tough, dirty war. A lot of people will be killed. A lot of wealth will be burned up. The accident of the geography, you know, Seoul being within artillery range of the guns buried on the reverse slope of the hills north of the DMZ, that's not very nice. But that's the hand we have to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I would favor, you know, playing it sometime in the next 6-8 months. I don't think we can wait another year before we help North Korea dismantle their nuclear capabilities and impose an international inspection regime that means they won't get them again soon. By the way, I'm pretty optimistic that we could do something that obviously is going to be hurt the South, and there'll be some losses there, but I don't think it needs to be Stalingrad or anything like, you know, if we've rebuilt Seoul a couple times,
mm-hmm.
we can do it again if we need to.
If we attack North Korea, is that going to bring China into the war?
I have no idea. You know, they came in the 50s because MacArthur insisted on going all the way to the Yalu. Had we announced that, you know, we're going to stop operations south of the Yalu, I'm not sure that the Chinese would have come in. But they couldn't stand to have American troops on their direct border. They needed some kind of buffer. So they intervened to protect, you know, a buffer stint between them and us. So, but it's impossible to say. I think if we handle ourselves well, and I'm, by the way, I'm talking about diplomatically here, if we handle ourselves well, we can reduce the backlash. I think people will understand that we cannot have nuclear munitions in the hands of a guy who has threatened to evaporate major U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why should we? And if we announce, look, we're going to give this problem 6 months or so, and if the North doesn't begin to dismantle this capability under international inspection, we will intervene. Tell everybody that. And there will be some people who will take pro forma objections to it, but I doubt if there will be anybody in the world who doesn't understand why we're doing this.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
I haven't read all three books through yet, but I have read portions. And one portion I enjoyed was the story of how you met Barbara Bush. Could you take our listeners? Our listeners through that story?
Well, in the run-up to Desert Storm, I went over to Saudi Arabia and climbed in the F-15. I was still current in the F-15, And I flew seven missions in a single-seat F-15, including one of them, which was a rehearsal mission for day one attack. And I was really, really impressed. I mean, our guys were ready to go. And so when I got back to Washington, this was in early January, somehow the White House found out that I had been over there flying with our guys, doing an on-the-ground assessment, you know, of were we ready or not. I think Colin Powell told the president, frankly. I don't know that, but I think so. So George H.W. Bush invited me over to lunch in the private quarters upstairs. And at that lunch was Dick Cheney, Brent Scowcroft, the president, and me. So it was just lunch for four people. And the question was, hey, McPeak, you just got back. You know, you took an assessment. Are we ready to go or not? And at the time, there was some talk about further delay. You know, this was in January. I think we'd already delayed once. But Colin Powell was not anxious to kick off the effort and wanted, you know, further diplomacy, further economic sanctions. Powell was a dove. You know, he has this reputation for the decisiveness theory, you know, the Powell doctrine. And he's a great guy. I like Colin Powell. He's a man's man, got a great sense of humor. But I thought we had grunted and groaned long enough, you know, for 6 months, for crying out loud, with Desert Shield. And we were ready, and, you know, our guys have been doing push-ups for 6 months, wind sprints, time to go.
Yep.
So I told the president that I thought, you know, yeah, let's go. And he was nice enough to say, don't worry about it, which led me to believe he was signed up to a mid-January kickoff for Desert Storm. Anyway, at the end of lunch, he invited me to meet Barbara Bush, who I had never had met. And he took me, and she had fallen down up at, she'd been up at Camp David, fallen down. And she hadn't broken her leg, but had hurt it, and it was in a cast. So he says, come on, I'll introduce you to Barbara. So went upstairs. Here she is in bed, the First Lady of the United States. She's wearing her pajamas with her legs sticking out from underneath the covers in a cast. And I met Barbara Bush, the First Lady of the United States, in their bedroom, you know, with her wearing her pajamas. And I thought to myself, nobody is ever going to believe this story. But that's how I met Barbara Bush. She's a wonderful lady. I really came to know her, you know, not real well, but pretty well, and I liked her a lot. I liked the senior Bush quite a bit. He was another good guy. So, but anyway, that's the way I met, and I still to this day. Now, I put the story in my book, Roles and Missions, so that people will now maybe believe it, because it's in print. But up until that appeared in print, I'm sure everybody would think I was telling tall tales.
And that brings me to your third and most recent book of the trilogy, Roles and Missions. What are the take homes from that book? What were the challenges to writing it, and what ideas and concepts did you most want to move forward with that?
Well, first of all, I talk about Desert Storm because it occurred on my shift and what were the lessons learned. Then I plunged in after that to reorganizing the Air Force. And I did from top to bottom. And I did some good things and I made some mistakes. But I used the themes of what are the functions of the, you know, the Title 10 functions of the armed forces. They are to organize, train, and equip units to be provided to operating commanders in theaters of operation. So I have a chapter on organize, I have a chapter on train, I have a chapter on equip. Those are the three things that I really pressed hard on, beginning with organization in 1991. But there were some issues that came along, Mogadishu and our experience in Somalia, which was awful. and mostly our fault. We got 20 guys or so killed there.
Mm-hmm.
And because of clumsiness on our part, in my opinion. And Bosnia came along, and the fact that we, NATO tried to do something there and were by and large ineffective during my time. And I thought we could be effective, and I made the argument for intervention on the air side to prevent such things as Srebrenica, where at least 10,000 Muslim men and boys were rounded up and killed by Serbians, and in a ethnic cleansing that was the worst since the end of World War II. And so there were other issues that came along, and where I argued for action that, by and large, was not taken, opposed by and large, really, by Colin Powell and the vice chairman, Dave Jeremiah, and the other, the other service chief. So I was kind of a loner, an outsider on some of these issues, and that story is told, all of it, in Roles and Missions.
What was the biggest issue that positioned you as an outsider?
Well, first, I argued in Desert Storm that we should have a Air Force deputy to Schwarzkopf. Colin wouldn't listen to it. I mean, it was supposed to be a joint operation, but he argued for and got Cal Waller, an Army three-star, appointed as Schwarzkopf's deputy in a repeat of mistakes made in Vietnam, where Westmoreland and later Abrams always appointed an Army guy as a deputy, and even in Korea, where MacArthur appointed Army deputies. Only Eisenhower ever got it right. I mean, going into D-Day, he had Air Marshal Portal, an airman from the RAF, as his deputy. So I argued for and got told to sit down and shut up that we need, if we're going to fight a joint war, we ought to have a truly joint headquarters with true joint representation at this in the senior ranks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time and only time, really, that I ever saw Colin get angry at somebody. And I'd only been a service chief for a couple months, so part of it was I should have observed a period of freshman silence, sit down and shut up. But I knew, and I think so did everybody else, that Desert Storm was going to be mostly an air operation, that air power would be decisive, and I felt we should have an airman, at the senior ranks inside the joint headquarters.
Yeah.
But Powell got upset at me because, I committed truth on this issue and said, hey, let's not go for phony jointness here. Let's have actual jointness. And, of course, Powell had this reputation that he burnished diligently of being above the Army, not playing the old Army game. He was a purple suitor, and it was, to some degree, a phony image, and I called him on it and got, and Powell got angry.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when I thought that we could intervene on the air side in the Balkans, I was told and not directly, because Paul Powell did this in Washington. He was very effective as an insider, in Washington. But I was the line was for Air Force for a long time. Air power advocates have overpromised and underdelivered. And here is yet again another case where McPeak is saying that they can take out some of these gun positions, which were right around downtown Sarajevo, shelling, the Muslims. He says he can take out these gun positions, but he does, he's going to overpromise and underdeliver once again, and we'll have to go in there on the ground and take them out. So this kind of argument was used, when my point was, we can at very minimal risk. These guys aren't going to shoot us down. We can. So it takes more than one sortie to take out an artillery position. Let's send in six sorties. They're mm-hmm. not going to shoot us down. It's safe enough to do. But Powell was bringing people into his office from around town, including, congressmen and senators, and saying, showing the pictures and saying, can find the gun position in this picture, mm-hmm. The camouflaged gun position. Anyway, that's sort of where I got myself crossways. And then after Mogadishu, I came back and said, hey, the other side is organized better than we are. We've got this two-headed monster in Somalia, and neither head is talking to each other. We had the straight leg, army, the 10th Mountain Division, and we had the Special Operations Forces in there. I mean, go see the movie Black Hawk Down,
mm-hmm.
where you find that the army wasn't really talking to each other. And we lost some very heroic people in there because the left hand didn't know what the hell the right hand was doing.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, by the time I got over and took a look at it and came back and reported to Powell, it was too late. We were pulling out. But we really got an egg on our face because the other side, the skinnies, in the film they call them the skinnies, these guys with RPGs and so forth, were better organized than we were. I mean, and none of them had gone to the National War College. So, anyway, I didn't like that criticism, but it was too late. Didn't make any difference in Afghanistan and in Syria.
On the ground in Baghdad, when Hussein surrendered, why didn't we impose martial law at that point? Where was the organization on the ground with regard to winning the war?
Well, remember, we sent a civilian in to be, Rumsfeld sent a civilian in.
Mm-hmm.
First, it was a retired Army three-star, forget his name, good guy. And then the disaster after that, there was a former diplomat, Army guy. He's the one who said, if you've ever been in the Ba'ath political party, you're out of a job. So all the guys that were running power plants and running the school system, people who remember the Ba'ath party, not because we were political, but because they joined the party to have success in their civilian job. It was a credential.
Mm-hmm.
All of them were thrown out. So eventually none of the power plants worked, the school system failed, and so forth. Then he said, he threw out all the officers that were ex-Iraq Army, just because they were ex-Iraq Army. So
mm-hmm.
you had all these Army officers hit the sidewalk, unemployed, no money in their pocket. I mean, it was a series of just disastrous decisions made by Rumsfeld's authority,
mm-hmm.
By the guy who had plenipotentiary power on the ground.
Hmm.
I mean, Colin Powell was sitting over in the State Department just trying to, pulling his hair out because he tried to do planning for the post-combat phase and was told by Rumsfeld to forget about it. It's a story that I called at the time self-congratulatory ignorance,
mm-hmm.
because it was full of arrogance and stupidity at the same time.
Hmm.
But I don't think you can blame the CENTCOM. I think you got to look at the Pentagon and Washington more generally to if you want to track down the villains of that piece.
Have you seen a big change in the last 40 years with our reliance upon special forces?
Yes.
And how would you describe it, and how do you see the future?
Well, I describe it as a good move.
Yeah, most people do.
I love these guys. Yeah. I mean, they are a warrior elite, the Special Forces, the Snake Eaters, not just Delta Force, but all of them, and the SEALs, and not just SEAL Team 6, but all of them, and, you know, the Rangers. These are my kind of guys, and they're the tip of the spear, and they've been turned to because they're the only answer we've been able to figure out to asymmetrical warfare against, you know, guys that are not in uniform, don't have anything to lose, don't have any property, don't really care, some of them, about their own life. I mean, these suicide bombers, talk about having nothing to lose. They're willing to give up their life and drive a pickup truck, you know, up to the sentry post. So regular armed forces are not much good against these guys. But the stuff we're doing that you would call special forces, including drone RPVs and Air Force special forces, this weapons and special tactics teams that are operating in support of Special Operations Command. These are good guys. And, you know, I mean, I think Special Operations Command now is too big because they're better if they're smaller, kind of like the Marines. You know, they were better when they were 100,000 than they were with 180, because they get to be too heavy-footed and bureaucratic. So keep them small, keep them tough, and I think that kind of answer is the best one we've come up with so far to dealing with forces whose operations are hard for us to understand when we were in our kind of bureaucratic, you know, behind the desk mode. So count me as a, you know, big fan of the Special Operations Force at this point.
Well, I want to thank you very much, General McPeak, for the time you've given us today. It's been extremely revealing. I know our fans are going to enjoy it very much. And catch your books, Hangar Flying Below the Zone, and Roles and Missions.
And, John, just let me say, I do have a website, GeneralMcPeak.com, GeneralMcPeak, all one word, .com. And there you can get an autograph copy, you know, if you want, and won't cost you any more than what they're doing at Amazon. So go on over to my website, and you'll see the whole display there.
Okay, I want to thank you for your service, for an absolutely excellent career, for wonderful books, for all this good advice, and for how you've contributed with the Ken Burns Vietnam, the Vietnam War documentary. Is that playing now?
Yes, it is. Well, it was played in September on public television.
Right. Okay.
And it's come back, and so you can find it. Also, it's on sale. You know, you can go buy the CDs.
Okay.
They're very good. Very good.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay, John. Nice talking.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. We have a new app. It's up now at the Apple App Store. It combines all our shows. It's free, and it's called 1001 Stories Network. That's 1001 Stories Network. And we'll have that Apple iOS app link in the show notes for you today, along with our new premium member subscription offer. Premium members will have access to all of our inventory at 1001 Heroes, 1001 Classic Short Stories, and 1001 Stories for the Road. And it'll be totally ad-free, with access to special features and bonus episodes. Many established podcast shows are offering a premium membership now, with rising hosting fees and lots of other expenses. Having a successful podcast or a podcast network takes a lot, and subscribers help out in a big way. And they get a lot in return. It's $2.99 a month, less than a cup of flavored coffee in most places, so help us out. You'll be seeing 1001 Stories Network app at Android and Amazon App Store this week.
By the way, Alexa users, you can now ask Alexa to play 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast, and you'll get the latest episode. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you again soon.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.